from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson and today for Dave Iverson. For even the most seasoned parents, everyday tasks like enforcing bedtimes and curfews, getting kids to pick up their rooms and tackle their homework, and managing family squabbles, raising kids can feel overwhelming at times. In the hour ahead, renowned child psychologist and parenting expert Alan Kasdan offers wisdom gleaned from 30 years of research on what strategies work and what tends not to with all kinds of kids from toddlers to teenagers. Dr. Kasdan is the director of the Yale Parenting Center and has a new book out called The Everyday Parenting Toolkit. Stay with us and join in the conversation. It's all ahead on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in today for Dave Iverson. There are as many parenting strategies as there are parents out there, and in each of our families, we may feel like we're reinventing the wheel given the specifics of our own children, our particular family makeup, our own memories of how our parents did it, and the baggage that comes with that. Ask 100 parents for advice on the same problem, and you can be pretty darn sure you'll hear advice as varied as the children on the playground. That said, there is to some degree a science to parenting, and our guest today, Alan Kasdan, has studied that science for decades and compiled 30 years of research into a guidebook of sorts. It's called The Everyday Parenting Toolkit, The Kasdan Method for Easy, Step-by-Step, Lasting Change for You and Your Child. Dr. Kasdan is a professor of psychology and child psychiatry at Yale University and is the director of the Yale Parenting Center. While he's written extensively on the topic of children and parents, many folks know him best for his 2009 book called The Kasdan Method for Parenting the Defiant Child. Now he's offered up a book of more general parenting advice for all those everyday tussles that families encounter. Dr. Kasdan, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, there's a lot of nitty-gritty in your book on parenting strategies, but before we get to that, I want to ask you to briefly touch on the science of studying parenting. And your book refers frequently to scientifically proven or evidence-based methods. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you set scientific standards and models in studying something with as many variables as parenting.
Well, actually, it's not as difficult as it sounds. And if one thinks of many variables, the analogy might be studying the weather, which is just filled with influences. And child rearing is almost like that as well. And in fact, one can evaluate and parcel out the role of parenting stress, the role of parent depression. One can actually test directly what nagging and reprimands will do. And when punishment isn't working, one can explore what actually does work and do studies on those. And so it's actually a very extensive science that just hasn't filtered out to the public.
And in your at the Yale Parenting Center, is it sort of an aggregate of you have such a wide sample? You've got a number of people involved over many, many years, which gives you the ability to draw conclusions?
Well, I think the nice feature about science is that it really doesn't depend on any one individual. And so the work that's really filtered into this book is the work of many, many people. I am one of them. And so what can we draw on science worldwide that might help a parent today get their child to clean his room? And so it is, I'd like to say it's just me, but in fact, it's many, many people who have been doing this science.
And your earlier book focused on defiant kids, oppositional behavior, that sort of stuff. And I'm curious why you've turned now to kind of the more ordinary daily conflicts and dramas in a family, and whether you found that most of the same techniques basically apply.
Well, there was actually a fascinating kind of pressure. You know, you can help with fire setting and get children to no longer be violent or beat up their peers or principals. Can't you get my child to eat vegetables? Can you give us something more concrete and less detailed that helps me get my child to bed on time, do homework, play the tuba? And, of course, these techniques can easily be adapted to that. And the demand became so great that the Yale Parenting Center now works with parents throughout the United States and actually all over the world, live, face-to-face, online, with a one or a few sessions to help with these kinds of problems. So the answer to the question is a response to really a demand, actually. Can you help with just the challenges of everyday life?
And when you're teaching behavior in so many ways, especially with young children, you're really, you know, you're obviously we're socializing them. We're teaching them societal rules. Whatever applies in the home translates to what a trained adult is able to do in the workforce. So it's a socialization. By teaching behavior, you're also teaching character and socially acceptable behavior in our larger world.
Absolutely. And so, you know, the feature of this book is if all that is going well and you're happy, there is no reason to go to this toolkit at all. But if something's a little stressful and something's not working very well, and you find yourself saying, if I've told you once, I've told you 1,000 times, that's proof that we need another tool. And actually, science has some of them.
All right. Well, let's get to the heart of some of your plan that you lay out in the book. And early on here, I'm going to lay out the phone number as well for our listeners, because while you're describing the ABCs of the Kasdan method, folks can listen and call in with their questions. If you want to join in the conversation, the number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on the website at kqed.org/forum. And again, speaking this hour with Dr. Alan Kasdan, the director of the Yale Parenting Center and the author of the Everyday Parenting Toolkit. All right, Dr. Kasdan, you call your plan basically the ABCs. Let's start with A.
So these are not quite intuitive. The A is antecedent, the antecedent, or what can you do before a behavior to get the behavior you want? And it turns out there's a lot you can do to get the behavior you want, and also a lot of normal things we do as parents that make sure the behavior won't come through. So, for example, you want to, if normal parenting is going fine, this doesn't apply. If you have some challenge getting your child to bed, the antecedents would be, you know, very clear instructions of exactly what you want to do and calmly. We ask that you put the word please in front of it, not to be polite, because please often changes the parent's tone of voice, and tone of voice alone can make it so the child's more likely to comply. If you can, give the child a choice. Could you put on your red sweater or your green jacket? We're going out. Why? The research is very clear. When there's choice, compliance is much greater. And so just on the antecedent side, I've named some of the things, and it's about what you do ahead of time and the how. And now you've increased the likelihood that the child will comply. So three parts, antecedents, behaviors, and consequences. I've just highlighted some of the antecedents.
Okay. And antecedents, you used the word also, I found very helpful, priming the pump. You use the term, you're prompting them. And you do emphasize that, you know, we're a very consequence-based culture. Everything sort of falls on the consequence. But that if you do this antecedent behavior as a parent, if you prime them for a positive response, if you prompt them in the right way, you really, you know, you've got 90% of the battle licked.
Totally. And so this is not a reward program, for example. And almost everyone who comes to us has a reward program that failed. And understandably, they failed. That's one part of a larger program. And antecedents can be so effective.
And related a little bit to, because as I was reading it, I was thinking, you know, this is very much how an adult would treat another adult in the workplace. This is how an adult would treat a friend. And not saying that we have to be friends with our kids, but it's sort of this baseline of setting a tone, not a demand.
Right. And you can, again, if you make it a demand, you'll get resistance. And then you'll end up saying things like, because I'm your parent or because I said so. And we know from those statements that that will make compliance much less likely than ever before. So when you go to authority and you go to power, you actually increase non-compliance. So it's not demands, it's requests. Now, many parents will say, this is my child, who's in charge here, I'm the boss. That's a misplaced emphasis. You want to build character in your child. You want your child to be kind, to be honest, and to comply. And so we're going to get you there, but it's not by pulling authority.
So I would imagine the priming of the pump, the setting the context, the prompting of a 5-year-old is significantly different than the prompting of a 15-year-old?
It is, but not significantly differently. Remember, these techniques in this toolkit book have been used from toddlers to geriatric patients. And so it's a wide range it works with. And so the how changes. So, for example, you'd still want to give specific instructions. You'd still want to give choice. But you might want to have some compromise negotiation with a teenager to bring them in on it.
What if you're a parent who hasn't had this approach at all and now you're with a 15-year-old? So say this is a new thing and they're going to feel like you're playing them, you're manipulating them. Is this something you can introduce to an older child?
Absolutely. And you have to be careful with the terms, the playing and manipulating. Remember, if you've come to the toolkit, you've been trying to manipulate this child in some way already.
And it's probably been
ineffective. So you want your child to come back on time when there's a curfew and tell you where he or she has been. And you've been trying to, using your word, manipulate that. What we're doing is saying that there's another way to get at that that'll be more effective and less stressful, but it gets you the goals you want. In this program, you select the goals. You're the parent. And get them your way. And if that doesn't work, reach into the toolkit. We have something for you.
Okay. What about B? A, B, C. We've done antecedent. B. What's B?
So B is behavior. And what the B is here is that you want to get the child to practice the behavior and actually do it many times. A best analogy of this is a musical instrument. As a parent, you want some Rachmaninoff piece. No, it's not going to happen. We work on gradually small segments and repeated practice. But we change the brain in the process of the repeated practice. Do this program 2 or 3 weeks. Forget the program, put the tool back in the kit. So among the key concepts is gradually shaping the behavior. You argue with your child for that 1 hour of homework because the teacher is on your back. He's not doing his homework. Well, we can't get that hour. We can get 10 minutes, 5 minutes and 10 minutes easily, then 20, then 30. Then we can get the hour and we can stop the program. But it's got to be gradual. The research shows that the gradual is critical.
Well, and as you say, when you're analogizing it to the learning music, you don't denigrate a kid when they've just learned the scale and say, well, I wish you sure could play that song. So if a kid's done 5 minutes of homework, you would say, great, rather than saying, well, you didn't do an hour. It's that gradual component, I think.
But here's the challenge. Here's the challenge. I'm a parent, too. And all parents we're talking about are humans. And as humans, we're hardwired in our brain to focus on negative things. That's how the brain is. It's very adaptive evolutionarily, but it isn't too adaptive in parenting. So your children are watching TV quietly, and you let them go. And now they start to argue, and you run in there and you say, why can't you ever get along? You're not going to be able to watch TV. No one goes to the prom, and you're going to not have your college education. And the technical term for that reaction of a parent is called normal.
You've been in my
and
home.
That, and you've been in mine. And so the issue is we're fighting some natural tendencies of focusing on the negative. For a parent, discipline means punishment. For this approach, discipline means getting the behavior you want. And that has very little to do with punishment.
Okay. And you talk about in the behavior step, the importance of identifying what you call the positive opposite of the negative. Explain that.
So here's the issue. If punishment worked really well, or even a little bit well, this would be called how to punish your child and get what you want. But the research is rather amazing here, that punishments do not teach the behaviors you want very well. They are pretty good at momentarily suppressing, but they won't change things overall. So you scream at your child for swearing, and that will stop him or her swearing right now on the spot. But the overall rate of swearing won't go down. And same thing, you show me respect because I'm your parent. Stop talking like that. That might get respect for the moment, but it won't change it at all. And so positive opposites, whenever you think you want to get rid of something, say to yourself, what do I want in its place? Now we develop that, whatever that is. We want your child speaking nicely. Your child is speaking nicely sometimes. You just let it all go. So we develop that, and the other part you don't like drops out.
So that's that reinforcing and that practicing of the positive opposite so that it ultimately replaces the negative.
That's right. And if you just keep suppressing the negative, no behavior will replace it. That's why the negative keeps popping back.
Okay. And now on to C, which is something that most parents are all too familiar with, and that is the use of consequences.
Well, they are. But the familiarity actually makes this task very, very difficult. And so consider, for example, praise, which is the main ingredient of these consequences. By the way, once in a while we use points and charts and stars, but to be honest with you, we use them for the parents, not for the child. And the reason we do that is that the parents do these programs, do praise better when they're doing something like a points or chart. So praise is the issue for the usual consequence. And there are two kinds of praise, to simplify it. One is the wonderful praise that parents normally do in their everyday life. Keep it up, do more, hug your child, don't change a thing. But the praise talked about here is based on research on how to change behavior. And that's a very different kind of praise, and we have to practice our parents in doing that. And that has some special ingredients, and perhaps you indulge me to mention what they are.
Oh, absolutely, because I think one of the things we've heard as a generation of parents is that we praise our children too much, and you're talking about a very different form of praise or use of praise.
Absolutely. And so for this, again, this is not to change normal parenting praise, keep it up. But when you want to get your child to go to bed or to speak nicely or do homework, we're in a different park now. Now we're talking about what does science really do that helps? Is there anything concrete? Absolutely. So for a young child, the praise should have three ingredients and they all make a difference. One, the praise should be effusive. That was really great. That makes a difference. That makes a difference. Then followed with that, it should say exactly what you're talking about. You picked up the toys just the way I asked. And now the third ingredient is you go over and touch. Okay? And so we practice those three ingredients, and they make a huge difference. Now, when you get to a teenager, now you have to be a little cool. So you cut back on the effusiveness. Hey, that was good. And then you go over and then you say what you did. And now you go over and some teenagers will shy away if you try to touch them. So just do a high five in the air. Same ingredients executed a little differently.
Just dialed back a little bit.
Absolutely. Now, praise that you don't want to do strategically is things like, oh, you really make mommy and daddy happy when you do that. Ugh. Never, never, never. Or I'm really, you're really a good boy because you did
that.
No,
why? Ugh,
never, 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 never.
Why?
Well, the research shows that this has actually a demoralizing effect on children. But the other thing is just common sense, and that is this. You're my child, and I love you no matter what. And your worth doesn't come from what you do. It comes from who you are. And I love you because of who you are. And that's the message for nurturing the child. Not as you did this and mommy loves you because you made mom happy. Ooh, no, my happiness doesn't depend on that you just cleaned up your room. My happiness depends on having you. And so it's not a subtle distinction, and it follows is a case where research and common sense come together, which isn't always the case. And so the strategic praise has the three ingredients I mentioned, but the non-strategic praise, can be helped a little bit too, because sometimes the message is odd. Then there's this funny thing in child rearing called caboosing, which is after you praise a child, you hook something on the end like a caboose, which is something like this. Gee, you did a great job. Now, here's the caboose. How come you always can't do that? Or why can't you do that like your sister does? And that, of course, that technical term for that also is called normal. Mm. But it undermines the effectiveness of praise.
Another thing you talk a fair amount about, and boy, we're pretty much all guilty of it in one way or another, is nagging. And you say the science and the evidence is very clear on nagging.
So we're in a trap. And by the way, I am a parent, and I'd like to once in a while think of myself as normal. So of course I have sinned. And nagging is this repetition to get this. What happens is that it leads to some subtle things. One of them is an effort to escape from you. Another one is an effort to avoid you completely. A good sign of that would be a teenager comes home and goes right into her room. Just get away from it. Is there any homework? How was school today? Did you have any of this? Did you whatever? And so the nagging tends to first lead to just no more compliance. And then finally, you start avoiding the person who's nagging.
All right. Talking this hour with Dr. Alan Kasdan. He's the head of the Yale Parenting Center. And his new book is for all of us out there tackling the mighty job of parenting. It's called The Everyday Parenting Toolkit. And he offers up some very sensible but sometimes counterintuitive thoughts on strategies for getting the best behavior out of your progeny. And the ideas mentioned in the ABCs are the keys. If you'd like to join in the conversation or pose some questions to Dr. Kasdan, you can join us at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. And we're going to go to your calls. I just want to add one more thing that I sure picked up, which was that you mentioned the importance of touch, not just you just mentioned it in terms of consequence, but you talk about it as very important in the antecedent stage too, that touch is this powerful tool in our box.
It is. We emphasize it more on the consequence side, because sometimes on the antecedent side, parents could push a little bit or force or move a child to his or her room. But touch is important there. You want to have your child clean his or her room, put your arm around the child, walk to the room and say, here, let's go to your room and let me help you. Let's start together. That's a great antecedent. But touch is turning out to be unusually important. It really changes a whole variety of bodily processes. Touch is even used with premature babies to help them develop and grow faster. So there's much more to touch than meets the eye, and it's extremely rewarding and adds greatly to anything like verbal praise. So, no, touch, critically important.
And I would imagine there's almost a measurable physical response. If you were to hook folks up, what they would feel, their response when they feel that touch.
Oh, I might add, this has been studied extensively in animal and human research, and in terms of the effects on all sorts of secretions and hormones and neurotransmitters, touch is really well studied, just the way you're saying.
All right. Let's go to some of our many callers. We've got Yvonne calling from Alameda. Alameda, good morning, Yvonne.
Good morning. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure, you're on the air.
Thanks. You know, we have a 6 and 8-year-old child, and they are, generally speaking, very respectful and great kids, and we enjoy them a lot. But they bicker all the time, and, you know, it's that brother and sister bickering, and we have tried taking things away and charting behavior, and, you know, as much as they love each other, they're driving us crazy with the bickering and the poking and the spanking and the giggling, you know, the running around and chasing until somebody gets upset. And I'm just kind of wondering, I'm listening to your advice and wondering, I'm thinking about this idea of touch and wondering, like, when I intervene, typically, is it a point where I need to now yell and that's how I get their attention?
Yvonne?
And what are... Yeah.
Hey, Yvonne, I'm going to stop you there because we only have a minute or so before a break. And I'm sure, something that is resonating with lots and lots of folks. So if Dr. Kasdan, if you can touch on it briefly, and then we're going to go to a break and we can come back to it after the break. But the bickering, is that an age old problem you see?
It is an age old problem. And this is something that I need to know more details, but just in the brevity of it all, here's what you might consider doing. In the morning, or just when they're both together, start something called the bickering game. And then you say to them at the beginning of the morning that we're going to have a period of time, only 10 minutes, and I'll bet you two can't go the whole period without bickering. I bet you can't do it. You just can't do it. Those are antecedents. That's not reverse psychology or anything cute. There's great research on this. And you give them a brief period and a challenge. And maybe at the end of that, now you run in and you say, I can't, you did this. You guys are so great. You're like adults. This is, you're not 6-year-olds. You're 16-year-olds. Keep that up for a couple of days. Start extending it. I bet you can't go to 20 minutes.
All right. That's Dr. Alan Kasdan, director of the Yale Parenting Center, and talking with this hour about how to handle our kids. If your kids are crawling up the walls themselves or driving you up the wall this July 4th weekend, join in the conversation, 866-733-6786. We have to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more questions and more from Dr. Kasdan. After a short break, I'm Penny Nelson sitting in for Dave Iverson, and you're listening to KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson, and we're talking this hour with Yale psychology and psychiatry professor Alan Kasdan. He heads up the Yale Parenting Center and has a new book called The Everyday Parenting Toolkit. He's also the author of The Kasdan Method for Parenting the Defiant Child. And if you'd like to join in the conversation, the number is 866-733-6786. And before we went to break, we heard from Yvonne, who I believe you're still with us. Yvonne, is that right?
I am.
So, and Dr. Kasdan was talking about something of a game, and you talk about that in the book. I think you refer to it as simulation. Can you talk about how other ways in which this technique is used?
So when the behavior occurs once in a while, we find that parents normally miss opportunities to attend to it with the praise I mentioned. And sometimes you can just change the behavior really quickly by just shifting parent attention and using the praise I mentioned to capture those moments in which it occurs. But sometimes the behavior never occurs, or it occurs so infrequently that you have to do something else. And so the best way to think about simulation is to think about training commercial airline pilots. We don't want airline pilots to be trained in the real world with flying us around the country. We want them to learn things under practice conditions, and those practice conditions transfer over. And same with children and child and behavior change. So, for example, the most common example we have thousands of times, a child will have a horrible tantrum, really a horrible tantrum, hitting parents, 45 minutes of screaming, breaking things. And so we'll have a tantrum game, and we'll tell the child we're going to play a game. And when everyone's calm, I'm going to pretend that you can't watch TV tonight, and you're going to have a tantrum, and this time you're not going to hit anybody, and you're not going to throw things. It's just practice. See if you can do it. And when you do that, you might earn a point on this little chart. Again, the points are mostly to help the parents do it. The child doesn't need the points. Now the parent says, no, okay, you can't go out. Remember, we're just pretending. Have a good tantrum and do these things. These are all antecedents. The child has a good tantrum, and now you do the praise, three things. That is great. I can't believe it. You had a tantrum without doing these things. That was great. Touch the child.
So it's that baby step of just changing the tantrum enough that they're not throwing things. So they're still having a tantrum, but they're not throwing things.
And if I might add one more thing to it, and then you say to the child right there, I'll bet you can't do that again. No child in the world could do two good tantrums in a row. That's an antecedent. Practice it one more, and you're done for the day. Do this for a week or two or three. The research isn't clear on that. We've done it 1,000 times, up to 3 weeks, worst case. And then now the tantrum is gone. The real tantrums take over. And they show what the simulated tantrums. And you can make the pretend tantrums less and less intense if you want to. But it carries over to everyday life just the way it does in pilot simulation training.
So, Yvonne, what have you done with your bickering kids? I mean, this is a new strategy. What have you been doing in the past?
In the past, what we usually do is we try not to intervene a bit and see, you know, if they can work it out themselves. And when they finally can't, or when it gets to a point where somebody's in tears or something somebody said or something somebody has done, we intervene. And we usually are, what we do is we take things away. So now, you know, you won't get to do this, or you won't, you know, get that, or whatever it is. I mean, something that is, you know,
a consequence.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah, but that doesn't seem to be working, obviously.
All right. Well, Dr. Kasdan's given you a game to start playing with your kids to see if they can learn. Now, how would she do the bickering game again?
Well, before the bickering game, if there's ever a time when they do work it out, it would be good to run right over to them and say, "That you worked this out and you didn't bicker for very long at all. That was terrific." And that will decrease the duration of the bickering.
Let me ask you this, because what I will do with them is if I hear them talking really sweetly or greatly to each other, I'll say, you know what, I love the way that you guys are talking to each other. That just is great, and it just shows me how much you care about one another. And is there research that kind of praise from your parent is helpful?
That praise is fine. It has a little baggage in there that you don't need, but it wouldn't hurt anything. But then make sure you touch. Make sure you touch.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Yvonne. Let's go to Brooke, who's calling us from San Jose. Hi, Brooke.
Hi. Thanks so much for the topic. This is great. So our family practices positive discipline, and this sounds very similar, which makes me excited to have the science out there of how this works. However, I'm curious. I feel like there's side effects. And for us adults that practice this, we can sound a little nuts in public the way we talk to our kids, because it's very counterintuitive what people are used to.
Well, explain what you do. I'm not sure what you do.
Like we're at the playground and, you know, my 6-year-old is wanting to go down the slide and there's another kid on the slide. So rather than saying, hey, get off the slide, that it's, you know, share or, you know, that's not your turn, rather than turn it be negative, I'll say something like, oh, hey, Pearson, it looks like your friend on the slide isn't done yet. Let's give him some time, and you can go when he's done. So you kind of turn it around, and some people are like, why? Just tell them to get off the slide, you know? so we sound different. We don't talk the same way as the fear and shame-based discipline style, where you're scaring the child and saying, we're going to have to leave the park if you don't listen to me, that type of thing. Although, you know, sometimes that's a consequence, but we just sound different. I guess my question is, when we're on the outside world and sounding differently, we also encounter teachers that are supposed to be part of a positive discipline philosophy at a school, but they're still using this kind of fear and shame-based carrot, you know, if you don't do this, this is what's going to happen. And sometimes it's hard for parents who've been talking this way to hear something that's very counterintuitive for us.
Dr. Kasdan?
So what you're doing, I would say, overlaps with what I'm talking about, but at the same time is very different. Now, to your wonderful credit, all those threats and the fear things lead to all their own side effects. So we are worried about side effects. The one to worry about is the one that you would have had if you weren't doing what you're doing. Children, the fear might get a quick behavior change, but it's a very risky strategy for your relationship. Now, let's switch. How is that different from what we're doing? No, what I'm doing here is rather very concrete, specific tools. And they're called tools for the following reason. You pull them out of the box, you use them temporarily, and you make the change you want. Then it's over. There's no special speaking on the park. There's nothing else in the grocery stores. It's over. And so these are really temporary, and they're used. You use a tool to hang a picture frame. You use a tool to get rid of a whole bunch of tools to get rid of your child's tantrum. And it's different from what you're doing. But what you're doing is certainly in keeping with get away from the negative things that children are exposed to.
All right. Thanks for the call, Brooke. We've got some emails coming in. Amanda writes, I've been using the Kasdan method at home for 2 months now. It's worked really well for 2 to 3 weeks, and now she completely ignores me when I prompt her to do tasks. She still gets some points, which keeps her getting prizes, but now it's not working to change the most troubling behaviors. She has some developmental issues that makes her really, really moody in the evenings and nights. We're unable to change behaviors when she's in the state, and unfortunately, these are the times that we're with her the most. So what do you encounter with kind of the longevity of the tool use? Do you have to shift it around?
No, not really. You could demand more behavior, but this will require a little more in-depth understanding of exactly what is and is not working. So, for example, I advocate really getting rid of the reward program, if you can, to make sure the emphasis is on praise. And it would be good to write down the exact things you want at these other times, just to help you be sensitizing yourself to catching them. And so these things, they don't lose their effects over time. It just goes the other way around. You lock in a habit. It's like someone who exercises for a year isn't going to lose it if you close the exercise place for a couple of days. And this is very much like that. So you want to get repeated practice. The key to this thing is repeated practice. So even if the parent practices this behavior a couple of times, let's pretend we have something called a doing game or a prompting game to get it occur when everyone's calm. Get it to occur and praise it. Get it to occur and praise it. And pretty soon you won't have to do that. And but I probably need more details on this program.
Right. And maybe if she – maybe that positive opposite of the negative is what needs to be looked at, to what she wants the child to be doing as opposed to not doing something like that.
The reward should be de-emphasized in these programs. You never want to have – you need something better and more. Now two cell phones and now a double trip to the marine park or something like that. So the rewards – they don't carry the weight of this, and reward programs fail because they don't focus on the practice.
Okay, we have now three pieces of input here that are all tackling the same thing, and that would be modern technology, something I'm sure you're all too familiar with taking on these days. So listener one here writes, my 2-year-old daughter is a bit addicted to the iPad. How do we break her of the habit, especially at bedtime? We read to her too, but she screams when we try to take the iPad away, saying, I need it, over and over. And then Tracy asks in another email, how do I get my 13-year-old son to do something, in particular get off the Xbox when he flat refuses? And I know social networking and technology has just taken hold in so many homes with tweens and teens, and obviously 2-year-olds.
Well, these are just really brilliant questions. Next question, please. So this is just an amazing obstacle, and it's starting younger and younger and going, you know, through college even. And so we have found the obvious here. There's no research on quite how to handle that the way we're talking about it. And the reason is it actually is addictive and actually does go to reward centers of the brain. And there have been people doing research calling it an addictive behavior, some of these technology things. And so one has to really limit it, have it in a public place in the home, and just have times. And the other times the materials are just not available. We have had children who have 12, 14 hours a day on the weekends engaging in video games or internet and at these points, you actually have to either get rid of things or limit them, really limit them. I mean, it's not possible. And, you know, if your child really feels that they're going to have a tantrum every time, you might have to get rid of it for a little while and just restore it. There's just no substitute for having it not around.
John is in Pacifica, and I think he has a question on the same vein. Is that right, John? Are you with us?
Yes, that's right. Hi, Penny and Dr. Kazin. So my question is, along the lines of computer. So we need to use our computer. I have a 16-year-old, and he would be described as oppositional, very bright. But he's going to do the amount of work that he absolutely has to do, and he'll be sitting on his computer saying, oh, yeah, I'm studying chemistry, I'm studying Spanish. And most likely he's also checking Facebook. He's checking the baseball scores. He's doing whatever. And so then when the grades come back and he's not doing as well as he said he was because we're trying to allow him to make his own decisions and to use his own time wisely, you know, how do we deal with the computer issue? How do we deal with, kind of having some duplicity, you know, about whether he's actually studying or not?
And Dr. Kazin, I will weigh in on this too. It's a very tricky thing when our kids do all their schoolwork online, including their research and their schoolology, and everything is online. But I look at the tabs and I'll see Facebook is open and Spotify is open and a chat is open. And yet we can't take the computer away because all the schoolwork is done via the computer.
And to add to that, as we all know, there's nothing that competes with this. This is really a social active. So for all kinds of reasons, this is not new and not actually related to the toolkit very much, but the computer has to be in a public place. It has to be in a place. It can't be in the individual's room. And the reason is not so much the things we've been talking about, because you've been talking about relatively benign distractions. But children go into some things that aren't so benign. And so there are these very aggressive video games. There are pornography sites. There are bullying. Bullying is actively going on. And you can do bullying anonymously on the web now. And so it's kind of for everyone's protection, not just homework. You almost want it in a public display. There's a little desk in which, you know, the family, you can see the screen, see what's going on. That's the only alternative that one can come up with, it seems, because you're right, they have to have access to this material.
Is there a way to apply ABC to this? This is such a common...
Absolutely. You could really, one thing is that have it so the child has a period that you designate after homework. But the period would be showing concretely exactly what was done. And if it was not done, the computer is just stopped. And when it is done, then you praise and you give the extra period of now a free computer time. So I would still put the computer in a public place, but you see the product. You can't hope for the behavior to occur. You'll see exactly what was done in this last half hour. Show me what was done. And now you have this free half hour unsupervised. And then stretch out the time. But you have to see what was done at the time. You must see, and that's the behavior part of this. See the product and then provide the consequence.
And I suppose that's also granting the teenager a level of adultness that I'm trusting that you can accomplish something. And so you act like an adult and accomplish something and you get the privilege of using a computer.
Yes, but you say it too nicely. I would not leave anything to trust at all. That's not how you develop behaviors in a child. That's hope. And hope is a dangerous strategy for child rearing. And so we say we have to see these five things done by 9 o'clock tonight. And when they're done, I leave you alone and you have an hour of computer time. And then if they're not done, the computer goes off. And then you, if it's a teenager, you try to negotiate maybe the time and how much is done and what's reasonable. But then you actually check it. You don't trust.
All right. Let's go over to Marlene, who's calling from San Francisco. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. So I was calling because I have a four-year-old son who refuses to go poop on the potty. And he's been T-trained for about a year now. And maybe 6 months ago, he came out with this thing saying, you know, when I'm 4 years old, I will go poop in the potty. And we waited till he was four, and now he's refusing. And we tried rewards, and now we've moved on to consequences. We're taking away groups of toys. Nothing is happening.
This will surprise you. I think this will surprise you. We have done this very often with antecedents. We've done it with modeling and rewards. But here's something that I think is the first try. We've been very successful with this. There's a cloud in the home that, again, this is normal. So please, if I'm presenting it, I mean no offense. It's normal. There's a cloud in the home of desperation. And the child knows without being able to say it or think it, the child knows that the minute that he or she does this, there's going to be rocky music and balloons are going to fall like a convention, that there's going to be such celebration because you guys are just so desperate for this to happen. You'll do anything to happen. And so what we need you to do, we actually practice parents doing this, we need you to not care so much right now. It would be nice to say to your child, you know what? You can wait till later. There's no rush for you. You'll be totally trained when you're older. Don't worry about it. When you're a big girl, it'll happen. By the way, the big girl is an antecedent that will help. Now, you have to really shrug your shoulders and continue the program with the idea that you and your husband aren't desperate at all. And just forget the reward business, forget the praise business, forget it all. And shrug your shoulders. We have parents practice and say, you know what, you'll get this when you're older. It'll happen. Don't worry about it. We're not going to worry about it. I don't want you to worry about it. We have had a couple of families where that toilet training took place that day, that same day. And so there's a sense of that your guys are working so hard at this. It's actually, it has a name. It's a special kind of antecedent that decreases the likelihood that you're going to get the behavior. And we have to get rid of that.
So stepping back,
Stepping, but you have to pray. That's so hard because the last thing a parent is about their child is nonchalant. And we want you to get yourself, I don't care. It doesn't matter. You don't have to say that, but you have to really believe it. Toilet train, not toilet train. It'll happen. Don't worry. Before you go to the prom, I'd like you to be toilet trained. But that's a few years off.
All right. Thanks for the call. We have an email here. Lisa writes, Dr. Kazin's suggestions are great, but they require a very high level of centeredness and self-awareness of the parent. What can parents do to step out of the daily work of being an adult and step into being a present parent?
Actually, I think that it doesn't require presence at all. And I don't really think you have to be very centered. And I'm wondering if my children would ever say that I was very centered. That's scary. But what it really requires is a different metaphor. And the metaphor for this really is, it's really there for a reason. It's a tool chest. And you don't have to be centered to get a pliers. And you don't have to be centered to get a hammer. You have to know how to use them. And now, right, if you come home from work in a stressful day and everyone's just screaming at you, you want to go to the toolkit and break a window. That I understand. But you don't have to be in any place as a human. We have worked with such diverse people and from diverse cultures, and we want you to get you to use the tool. Use it just for one little thing. Get that one thing you want in your child. Then we'll go on to the second thing. And then we'll go on to the third thing. But it doesn't really require that much of togetherness at all.
Because as you say, it's these three elements and these basic components. Each element has its basic components. And if you just adopt them, you don't have to be present in it.
That's right. And there are many options in each of the areas. So if you say, I don't want to do that, or I'd never do that, or Kasdan knows nothing about that, all those are fine. There are different kinds of tools. And so you can pull different kinds of antecedents and find the one that suits your family and your life and try it. And you know what? These are things to try. They're temporary. They work usually relatively quickly. If it's not working, showing anything in a week or two, dump it.
All right. Another email asks Andrew notes that he lived in Europe and noticed that children there seem better behaved and wonders, is there a culture factor in children's behavior?
There is a cultural factor in children's behavior. That doesn't mean I'm saying Europeans are more well-behaved than non-Europeans. I have no evidence for that. Also, Europeans are such a diverse set of cultures that I'd never want to talk about the continent in any uniform way. That said, some families have stronger expectancies for their children than others. Some families have many more extended family relatives around, and those relatives convey values and modeling for behavior. So those influences are very important as well. So yes, there are many, many differences, but the tools still work across culturally.
Are there differences that you've noticed in all of these years between the conflicts and the conflict resolution that moms and daughters have, that moms and sons have, that dads and sons have, and dads and daughters have?
We haven't really worked on that part of it. We hear about a conflict and we adapt the tools for that particular one to get rid of it or reduce it or resolve it. And so we haven't tried to classify or categorize in the way that you're suggesting, which would be very interesting.
I wonder, because it seems like there's always this set of problems that moms have with daughters as opposed to moms with sons.
Oh, we've seen that endlessly. You're totally right. We've seen that endlessly. But the part that I can't address is that do they need to be treated in any different way? And it doesn't look like they do. But you're right. There are these standard kind of things that you almost want to roll your eyes if you're a parent going through one of them. Or a neighbor saying, I've been through that one myself with my daughter, with my son. So there. You're right. There's a standard repertoire.
Let's go to Tanya, who's calling from El Cerrito. Hi, Tanya.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask about my 5-year-old, and the cloud of desperation did sound a bit familiar, who just is extremely limited in what he's willing to eat. Like, basically, he will eat variations on bread and cheese or macaroni and cheese, you know, like a quesadilla or a cheese pizza, and we can really only get him to eat about 3 fruits or vegetables, you know, one being applesauce. And, you know, we've tried bribing with, you know, the promise of a cookie or something, which can sometimes get a few bites if it's not something he absolutely abhors. And we try what they do at his preschool, which is having him take a no thank you bite of everything, or even touch it to his lips if he's unwilling to bite it, you know, which is supposed to lead to him eventually eating it. But we haven't had much success with that leading anywhere.
And how old is he again, Tanya?
He's 5.
Dr. Kasdan? So,
well, first of all, you've done absolutely the right thing, but with your tasting it, putting it to your lips. That's really very good. And so I would keep that up. And is there a vegetable of choice? Is there something that would be a very tempting vegetable, or a very tempting vegetable with a sauce? And so I would put that in there. But I think the issue is that I would model it at the meal that everyone takes just a little bit on their fork and touch it to their lips and puts it down. And that's all you're asking for. And then you praise it and you leave it at that. And then you move slowly. You have to have a plan to what the next step would be. And after 2 nights of that, I would now move it so it goes on your tongue, and you just have to leave it there or swallow it or wash it down with some other food, and you move very, very gradually. And then I would have it only 1 or 2 nights a week. And all nagging has to go away, all desperation has to go away, and the praise should be, this is really great, look what you did, and then just go on to other things. Make sure you get off of that as quickly as possible. This will not be hard to do. In the book, there's actually a good example describing a game of how to get that at the dinner table, because we're confronted with this endlessly as a serious problem. So there, in the book, there's actually worked out detail on it.
And it seems, Dr. Kasdan, like a lot of this really comes down to power struggles. So whether a child – of course, we want kids to eat well, but – ultimately, I think a lot of us, we end up really involved in a power struggle more than invested in any outcome, whether it's using the potty or eating certain foods or getting a room cleaned up. It's really about the power struggle.
It is, and it's unfortunate, but again, I would call that normal. Here, this thing you brought into the world, carried around on some carrier, could barely talk. Now they're saying no. Now they're saying they're not going to do this and you have to get to work. I mean, where does that come from? Who are you to say that after all I've done and you're only 3 years old? So all of that is natural. But the strategy has to shift in this way. I would like to get you to do some things with minimum stress and with maximum speed. And if I put power out of that, I can do that much better. So once you put it as a battle of wills or who's in charge or choose your battles, once you frame it that way, you've lost, completely lost. The issue is this: how can I get you to be a decent human being in the ways that my spouse or partner and I think are important? And say what those things are. Point them out in the world. Model them. Praise the child when you see any segment of it. And it's a whole different game. You gain power by not invoking it.
All right. Allison in Napa, join us. And you need to be brief because we're running out of time.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment to Dr. Kasten's antecedents, which worked perfectly for us when my son was in high school. He decided to cut his own hair into a mohawk. And we are relatively conservative people. But somehow we heard about him doing this, and so my husband and I decided we are not going to react to this. But instead, when he came home and was expecting some shock value, we both looked at him, and I said, "Oh, well, Henry, you cut your hair. Do you like it?" And he just simply didn't know what to say because I think he was expecting reaction.
You took the wind out of his sails is what you did, Allison.
Well, kind of. I mean, we just said, "Wow, that's interesting." We really treated him respectfully. We just figured it was just hair. And, you know, the very next day he cut his hair back to a regular haircut.
Oh, Allison, that's
we never even had to tell him to do that, but he just sort of went, "Oh, I don't really like this."
Well, that's a great call to end on. Thanks for the call. And Dr. Alan Kasden, I am afraid we are out of time. It's been great having you on this hour and tackling some of the many questions that Bay Area parents are facing with all of our kids. So thanks for being with us. Dr. Kasden.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Dr. Kasden's professor of psychology and child psychiatry at Yale University and also the director of Yale's Parenting Center. And his book is called The Everyday Parenting Toolkit, The Kasden Method for Easy, Step-by-Step Lasting Change for You and Your Child. Also the author of The Kasden Method for Parenting the Defiant Child. And thanks to all of you who called in and wrote in as well. Forums produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lorberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks and Chad McCullums. Our senior producer is Dan Zoll. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our interns are Max Walker-Silverman, Asal Unisani-Pau, Keelan Cronin, Maddie Pelton, and Jonathan Tam. I'm Penny Nelson, in for Dave Iverson. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Sue Ann Gershenson Trust.